Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale and today I am very pleased to be talking to Ed Zwick. He is a director and producer and writer and the author of a new memoir, Hits, Flops and Other Illusions. It's a wonderful book. It's very funny. It's full of great stories and anecdotes and some great advice as well. Something I heartily recommend you read. But I think that I don't need to really introduce this one. I think this one is going to speak for itself. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to do all the things I ask you to do every week. Tweet, X, or post, or share, or review, all of those things. But before you do any of that, please enjoy this very special conversation. I've ever read a book by a director who is so expansive in giving credit to their collaborators. And I'm not just talking about the big collaborators, which we can talk about as well, but you really give credit to your ADs, to the catering staff, to the extras. I loved that depth.
Well, anyone who does not acknowledge those people who contribute in that way, I think is shaming them. I think that there's a mythology about movies. I mean, at first we think the actors make up the words, that the piano has invented the concerto. We think that somehow the director has somehow magically contrived to create this whole universe. But also, I think that has been perpetuated by a kind of self-aggrandizing description of what the process is. And this is not to minimize what I do, because God knows I believe that what I do is difficult, and I've paid the price for it in every aspect of life. But so too has that dolly grip who's made 10 times more movies than me, and so have the guys in the trucks and the people who've sewn the costumes. And when you actually dig down into the enterprise, the scale of the enterprise, particularly if it's something that obliges you to do things at scale or in period or with effects. You know, I mean, the concern with it's an industrial workplace, and the concern with safety, and the attempt to, it's a graduate school in research, whatever period is, and it's a factory, and it is so many things. And I think that for me, because I came from the theater, which is a cozier, more familial little group, really, that's, you know, unless the production is enormous. But there is the feeling of ensemble, right? And as I made that transition, it became so clear to me, the difference was so marked, and I knew fuck all nothing. And so I really applied myself to trying to learn everybody's job, to see what was going on there, and that in deconstructing it, that I could then take advantage of what I'd learned. And in fact, I think that unless you are so self-confident and capable of ignoring the rest of it, it really serves someone to be able to know that, and you can maximize the dollars, and you can maximize the workflow and the economies of scale, and all the things that make movies. So I guess when I sat down to write it, let us say the book was entirely hand to mouth. There was no great agenda. There was no. Although I think there developed one certainly as I wrote, and there was no outline that said do this with the book and try to. It's what came out, and that improvisational feel that I was trying to do, and almost conversational feel, if you will, is where what led to those things. Because I'll stop in a moment. No. I know I'm rambling. When I looked at when I went back and looked at the films, which I'd never really done, what I was struck by was the order of magnitude of the enterprise. How did we do that? What were we thinking to do that? How presumptuous to think you could, you know, do something anti-entropic and hold back the universe so as to create this little bit of 1890s Japan, or, you know, a tank battle in the Gulf War, or God knows whatever. And that's just kept striking me. And who were the people who did that? How did we do that? You know, when you read Moby Dick, when you're a young man, you read about Ahab chasing this whale. But when you read it when you're older, you're very interested to see how much energy is devoted to the ropes and the knots and the harpoons and all of that, the actual work.
Absolutely, absolutely. And going to the origins of this book, this is coming out of COVID. It's one of the better, while we were all making sourdough bread, and I was teaching on Zoom. I think this is a better creation.
Well, it's not an ill wind that doesn't blow someone some good, right?
So it came from that. It forced you, and it was the collapse of the project. So it, you know, there's the ill wind right there, is the collapse of the 30-something sequel. And you say there was no agenda, but I really enjoyed. I was really interested in the way the book sort of develops sort of non-chronologically, that you don't start, okay, I was born in this place and off we go.
I was determined not to do that. There's a wonderful phrase that Elmore Leonard once wrote. He said, I choose to leave out the parts that other people skip.
Oh, that is so beautiful. That's excellent.
Isn't that good?
Raymond Chandler once said, nobody's interested in when a writer got his first bicycle.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. And that was, by the way, that was a more, I think, a writerly decision, that there could be backstory and exposition on the fly, and that the book could jump back and forth in time. And that if you miss one bus, there'll be another bus coming by, you know, and that would eventually aggregate into a whole portrait, you know, because it's all a mosaic anyway. And by the way, there's the elasticity of film that somehow it is wedded to also.
Yeah, I mean, the most obvious comparison would be like Citizen Kane, in which you sort of achronologically build up a life. I'm not suggesting right. that you are Citizen Kane.
Why, thank you for that.
I don't think it's very flattering. I mean, Orson Welles, yes, but not Kane. So going back to the sort of the collaborations, one of the things you begin with really is your collaboration with Marshall as a very close,
yes,
and almost like a, mm-hmm, an inciting incident in a way, because he lifts you and helps you. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of talk about that a little bit?
Well, I mean, I had two sisters. I never had a brother. You know, I was always involved in sports and team sports. So I'm oriented toward that anyway. But I can't describe, you know, what it is to fall in love in that way. You don't plan on it. On the other hand, it was a cauldron. It was a crucible of great pressure, and I think it became clear, even as a survival technique, that you needed some feeling of alliance, some notion of shared struggle, and you gravitate towards someone that mirrors you in some way, or who completes you in another. And I think that he was both of those things. He was obviously so gifted, I think intimidatingly so, I thought, and yet very modest, actually desperately insecure, and that in some sense my own compensatory brashness was maybe a thing that he was able to partake of and looked at as an additive, and that's only describing the more manipulative aspects of why you're drawn to someone, you know, because everything in Hollywood in those friendships seems to be acquisitive, seems to be, you know, aspirational. How can this person help me? Or what, and you know, when you arrive here and you're floundering, you grab at any life raft. But this obviously became more than that very quickly. And what revealed that was obviously the friendship, first of all, but also that the work as the sensibilities as we began to join each other more intimately, which is to say, you know, in this film school, yes, I acted in something that he directed. He shot something that I wrote. We all did sound for somebody else. There was this very deep end of the pool approach. It's like a conservatory approach. And we did that. But it really wasn't until we said, okay, now we're out of here on our ass. Nothing is happening. And what are we going to do? And I was at a point in my life in which writing was, the actual act of writing was still very difficult for me, contorted and constipated. Mm. And it was for him too. And somehow together we were able to break through that a bit and push the other. And that role of being each other's scourge was very important then and continues to be, not as much about the actual doing of the work, but the self-teaching, the idea that when you leave any kind of an academic environment, you're not done. You've taken in so much. You've tried to internalize what people have said to you, but until you've had the actual practical experience of applying it and watching how it is harder than you think, or how it works, or in fact how disappointing it is that you have not measured up to those, you know, gods that you've been exposed to. And what you have to understand is we were there at this remarkable moment that moment in the mid-1970s when the men, all the great giants who had created that art form, were still alive. I mean, they didn't, you know, they invented it, you know, and if we had King Vidor sitting there talking to us, or God knows, Orson Welles, you know, but others like, you know, these, you know, Richard Brooks and Paul Mazursky and John Frankenheimer, it was on and on. And then men earlier than that, you know, Bogdanovich was still interviewing some of the really the founders of it. Anyway, the point is there was a thing that they had created and they felt obliged or desired to pass on. And that was the American narrative film tradition, which had essentially created an art form, or at least certainly promulgated it throughout the world. And they felt that that's something that needed to be learned or at least taught. And, you know, for better and for worse, I think we became its spawn, because.
But I mean, what spawn? You have, in the sense, you have, this is the AFI conservatory. You have David Lynch in the stables making a Eraserhead. Yep. Yep. Terrence Malick has just was in the first year. Paul Schrader with him. I mean, yep. As far as spawn goes, it's got to be some of the best spawn I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, yes, and I think one reason is that this is an irony. I'm talking about the American tradition, and yet those taught us were hardly American. It was Janosch Kadar, who was this great Czechoslovakian film, and is the conservatory was created by Frank Daniel, who had created the Prague Film School, and also it was Nina Foch, who was an American, but actually Danish, and actually had been a sort of the disciple of Uta Hagen and Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, and that what they were trying to teach us was some self-reliance, some belief in your own voice, and the ability to try to reconcile that with a commercial universe that was awaiting you. And when you evoke David or Terry Malick or Paul Schrader or John McTiernan was in our class, Amy Heckerling, and so many others since then. I think one reason why they have flourished is not just the pedagogy, because there are places that teach that very well. A place like SC is, you know, technically just so sublime, you know, and NYU has something else that it offers. But there was something so unique and differentiated between all the voices that would somehow emerge from there. And that had been encouraged.
It's almost like a mixture of the traditions. You've got the American on one side and the rest of the world coming in. Amazing. Mm-hmm. And so when you leave the AFI and when you start out, you start working in television you sort of do your apprenticeship, if you like, before you break through with the TV show that you and Marshall sort of create together. Mm-hmm. And this show nowadays looks like the beginning of the golden age of television. It feels like it's the beginning of, you know, okay, there's a few hops before we get into, you know, that steady block, mm-hmm. but there's this, there's Twin Peaks, and then, you know, we're off to the races.
Yeah. I think one reason, and you evoke Twin Peaks, which is David, or even Miami Vice, sure. which was Michael Mann, or, you know, there were that we were young filmmakers or had set out to be filmmakers who found ourselves doing television. And if you remember the state of television at the time, particularly drama, comedy was already beginning to flourish in this way. There were classic comedies, you know, of the Carl Reiner variety and the, you know, the Norman Lear variety, but in drama, no. Drama was a wasteland. Drama was populated by these families that seemed to be aliens to me. They were so appropriate and so sweet and kind and so
this is the Waltons and the Ewings in Dallas and
Oh, but even, you know, make room for Daddy and My Three Sons and the stuff we grew up with. It was just so bizarre. But at that time in the world of film, and maybe a year or two before, several things had been happening that we were totally fascinated by and loved. John Sayles did the Return of the Secaucus Seven. Larry Kasdan did The Big Chill. You know, years before that, a few Bergman had done Scenes from a Marriage. And there was the whole history of the well-made family drama in the American theater, which was Arthur Miller and William Inge and William Gibson and all of that. So that we weren't inventing something, but we were adapting it to a different medium. We said, all right, television, can we find what is epic in the personal? Can we create structure and shape and narrative interest and stakes about things that seem pedestrian and quotidian? Mm. And that was new, and certainly new for a continuing drama. Although already at that point, it was being done in this sort of risible way in soap opera. You know, soap opera were just about these people who would be having affairs and betraying each other. And it was melodrama, but it was continuing drama. So you take all of those, the different values of psychological insight, of a more deft and amusing writing, you know, of themes that played along with the day-to-day, that there were often, you know, that there were often there was a dialectic that we were trying to write about, and that was that was new. And it was about the dialectic of experience and about ambivalence and about the conflict that's internal or even interpersonal about that unlived life and that dissatisfaction in life, and yet juxtaposed against its joys. And to me, that's a theme. And that was enough to energize a continuing story, because that's a story, that's a theme that never ends, and it crosses age and race and gender. It's everywhere, that theme. And it's a theme that people were quite astonished by and many very threatened by, because it's subversive as a theme to the status quo.
But it's sort of almost against a sort of like the American dream or the Eisenhower sort of happiness thing, is people getting to being 30 and being relatively financially not too hard off, and then saying this might not be enough, you know, questioning success, essentially.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's just society and its discontent. There you have it.
Another benefit of your partnership with Marshall here is that when you are offered the possibility of you do a TV movie together, mm-hmm. and then when you are offered the possibility of going off on your own and making a movie, you have someone. It's not a case of, okay, I have to drop this and just burn my bridge and go on. You can sort of leave it in his hands while you go off and make your film.
Absolutely. And that became a blessing in so many ways. Not just that it we're able to keep a company alive and keep the lights on, but also, you know, as you begin to raise families and you have a mortgage and you it enabled us to keep solvent while waiting to do the things that we love to do. In other words, if you think of some of the movies that we did, I read the novella of Legends of the Fall when I was 22, and I ended up making the movie at age 40. You know, Shakespeare in Love was 7 or 9 years all in. Legends of the Fall. I mean, these things take time. And I think what ruins a career in a minute is having to take a job. Mm. I think when you take just a job, if you can afford not to, it tars you. It identifies you as someone who is compromised. And obviously, if it's about feeding your family, you take any job that you have to. But if you're in that liminal space between that and actually trying to have a career that expresses something more than the 2 hours that somebody sits there, you got to find a way to skin that cat. You got to find a way to keep your nut down. You got to find a way, or to teach, or you have to find a way to be wildly successful. Like, you know, you know, George Clooney sells tequila, you know, whatever. Ryan Reynolds now has a phone company. I mean, I don't think that that's actually trying to keep the lights on. I think that's just about trying to rule the world. But still, it is a thing that you have to figure out.
Absolutely. Who's got vodka? Dan Aykroyd, I think, has his own. Yeah.
Does he? Actually, Liev Schreiber, I saw in New York, he has joined in with some guys who are now they're creating Irish whiskey from some place in some peat bog somewhere, and it's called Schlante, which is, you know, what one says with a glass of Jameson. So I guess that's the latest. First actors only want to be rock stars. Now they want to be entrepreneurs.
It's I don't know.
And they want to own football clubs. Look at Wrexham. I mean, there you go. We're just invading your turf.
Well, we have someone. Liverpool's my team, but we have the guys who own the Boston Red Sox own our team. So
that's right. Right. Sorry about Liverpool on Saturday. By the way,
Why did I bring that up? This is where the interview goes south very quickly. Looking at the, you moved back and forth between TV over this period, but moving on to your movies, what struck me throughout the book is I kept being surprised as you got into another chapter and saying, you know, you'd leave on a cliffhanger and say it. But next I was thinking about doing this and I was thinking, oh my God, yeah, I remember that. And because they feel so different as films. They feel like you're moving from glory, from About Last Night to Glory, and then from Glory to... that process is...
Well, I mean, that bespeaks something that goes all the way back to having been in the theater and having been trained in the repertory theater, where you do Strindberg one night and Sam Shepard the next, where you do a Molière play.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And then you do an experimental rock musical. That, you know, that is where I come from. Sam Mendes is actually a pretty good example of that too. If you look at his work, both in the theater and in film, that he has always done that in a brilliant way, I think. And he tends to apply the principles of one to each in this very interesting way.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of my favorite James Bond movies as well, he managed to direct, which I was very pleased. Skyfall. He did Skyfall.
Yes,
Skyfall,
right.
And Spectre, which... was not as good as Skyfall, but was still okay.
Yeah. Of course you did.
So when you go on Glory, I think it almost feels like you have quite a good experience doing About Last Night. Feels sort of quite contained, but then you go on Glory, and it's kind of like a tale of two cities or a tale of two actors in a way, because you have Denzel on one side, mm-hmm. who feels like you discover, not you're discovering him.
It's a revelation. It's a revelation. Yeah.
I just watched him in Equalizer 3, and they're not the kind of films I usually love, but him in that, I just watch him in anything. He's just so good.
It's some sort of some magic. I can't describe it. It's this ineffable thing. He is watchable. There's something happening in his process, or your insight into that process, or his presence. Or there, I could talk about it for a long time, and I think I go overboard talking about it in the book. It's a very rare thing, and it's unique if you think of how enduring it's been for how long.
Yeah, I can't think of many who have remained up there in terms of quality and in terms of visibility.
Right.
Everybody has their sort of four or five-year peak, and then they're on the other side of the hill. But Denzel, I don't think he's ever going to be. I mean, The Tragedy of Macbeth, I think, was one of the best films I've ever seen him in. One of his best performances, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of the equation, your relationship with Matthew Broderick, which is, to say the least, problematic.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, I mean, obviously, I tried to find some compassion in writing about it. I understood he was in a circumstance that is not actually enviable. He had personal things going on that were traumatic. He had the misfortune of being given the responsibility at 24 of thinking that the success or failure of the production rested on his shoulders. And he had this mother who was, a Gorgon, and overbearing, again, out of love and protection, as so much chaos is created out of love and protection. But it was I blame him for, and it's not even blame, is his passivity. Right. If he was the architect of it, it was all behind the scenes. But I suspect that when you're that age and you are surrounded by the fluffers and the whisperers and the handlers and the 10%ers and that you're just overwhelmed, and also this bubble is created around you. This bubble of constant affirmations and constant actually not just affirmations, but the subtle instigation of the opposite, these weird depreciations that are cloaked as affirmations, but in fact are destructive. And that's your world. Mm. And it's a hard one to survive, and some don't, and some do.
I guess if somebody's always telling you that this is your best side, you also hear that that must be your worst side.
Exactly, by extension. If there is a best, therefore there is a worst one.
You've worked with the biggest stars in Hollywood: Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, and they all, you talk about them extensively, and also Julia Roberts. You have a situation where you almost comes together for Shakespeare in Love. I think that also strikes me as one of those episodes where it feels like it's almost like you're trying to hold on to butter. It's just flying out. You know, there's no way. The harder you squeeze, the further it'll go away from you.
Yeah, I would think of mercury.
Right.
Trying. Have you ever tried to pick up a piece of mercury in your hand?
No, I will. I'd forbear.
Well, I mean, no. It's like, I remember once a thermometer broke, and there was mercury on the ground, and you saw just how utterly impossible it was to contain it.
I mean, when you had those experiences with Shakespeare in Love, of course, the you know, if Julia Roberts was the beginning of the you know, choppy waters, then Harvey Weinstein, I mean, you refer to him in the, he's the typhoon. I mean, you refer to him in the in the book as sort of like, there's what you say in the, I think it's in the beginning of the book, you know, there'll be this, there'll be that, and there will be one instance of pure evil. And I'm assuming that's who you're. I'm assuming that's the.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. It was indelibly. I mean, I'd had a nice run. And yes, there'd been the problems, but I'd never seen that kind of malign energy. I'd never come face to face with that bald aggression. The word actually that I always think about is fascism. Right. You know, one can be a fascist in business. One can be a fascist in the dominance of other people or the negligence of other people's humanity. And what I came to realize very quickly is that people like that do well in the movie business. They do well, not always, but they do because it's ungoverned. There's no HR, or there certainly wasn't in those days, no real scrutiny of behavior. If you succeeded, you were indulged. And he did succeed. Now, his methodology was hateful. It was even hateful to other filmmakers, which no one realized, is he would say, he would find seven films and say, I love this. I'm going to put this out for my the Oscars. And it's another one. And he would do that to seven films a year. And then he would, like a shotgun, shoot them out into the culture. And whichever one stuck, he would then jump on and ride to the finish, at leaving six other bodies strewn in various places and dreams shattered. And that was his MO, but it worked. And he was able to sell that. And what people don't also realize is people like that are also enormously seductive. He had a great line of patter. He was not ignorant of the process. He was schooled in it. He was, you know, in the way that someone like Quentin knows every single bit player in every single movie. I mean, Harvey was really sharp in that. So you assumed that therefore he was also in some way noble, or that he was genuinely attached to what filmmaking was. And he wasn't. He was attached to the product and the self-glorification that comes from certain films, and with no mindfulness or compassion for those who make them.
In fact, his sort of vandalism became another part of his character even before he fell, in terms of the old Harvey Scissorhands reputation.
Well, that's it, by the way. And there was financial chicanery too, and there was the withholding of funds to people, and the, you know, there, all of those things I felt were probably felonious back then, had he been, you know, more scrutinized. But when all that started to come out, and this is already years later, because I think, God, we're talking, when was Shakespeare in Love? Like, you know, mid-90s or something, right? You know, something like that. And then all the Me Too stuff starts, you know, like about, what, 2010? You know, so he had quite a run of being sub rosa. And that too, by the way, when you think about it, had to have taken an extraordinary enterprise. And when you think of the people who were complicit in abetting that, that makes it even more horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember just talking about the HR element. There's a great film called The Assistant, where the assistant goes to the HR, and the HR lays it out to her. Okay, you want to complain about this? Yeah. This is what's going to happen to your career, and this is what's going to happen to the guy. So,
I thought that was a very lovely movie. Julia, I know a little bit; she's great in it, and also that it's so underplayed. It's so wonderfully unspoken what's happening in the universe around her, which I thought was a little great to see that microcosm.
Absolutely, less is more. It definitely sometimes works in that sense. You're at this point, you're still working in TV. You go back and you do the wonderful My So-Called Life with Claire Danes. And in fact, this is another aspect of the book that I enjoyed, was suddenly hearing these names and thinking, Claire Danes, oh, I love her from Romeo and Juliet and Homeland. Oh my God, yeah, I remember she started in that. And Jared Leto as well. And you know, it's really interesting you describing how Claire Danes, as effectively a child, operated on that show. And it's so heartening to hear how you were able to work around her, because, you know, we've heard recently in terms of Nickelodeon, places like that, that's not always been the case.
I don't know the story you're referring to, but I do know that you know, child acting was often a very subtle form of child abuse, and saw so many people who were the casualties of it. You know, Claire is the opposite. Claire was in some weird way fully formed from the minute we met her, and she has only grown and grown in her life with these kids and this very interesting catalog of work, which continues. I mean, one of the pleasures is when people walk into your office or a casting room and you see something that just is undeniable. And there are often those moments when you can't partake of it. In other words, someone walks in. I was going through old casting sheets the other day because we were throwing stuff out at the office. And I saw these names of people who'd come in that I had just basically passed on because they weren't right for the part. Oh, my God. That's Bradley Cooper. He was there twice for two different movies, and I didn't give him a second thought. And no, there's, you know, whoever. I do tell one story in the book about Annette Bening, who was someone who was up for a part in 30-something who we did not cast because she wasn't right for what we'd written. And then there I am working with her 15 years later. And she reminds me of it because actors never forget that shit.
And I think you say to her, "You're welcome." You know, you could.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's because I had the good sense to make it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then on that side, you've got people like Claire Danes who you're seeing maybe for the first time, maybe introducing to the world. And then on the other side, when you're working with someone like DiCaprio, who is at the height of his fame on Blood Diamond, and Tom Cruise on The Last Samurai. Both, you know, absolute megastars. I mean, that calls for like a different approach, different responsibilities. I mean, the image of you racing a horse with Tom Cruise across, just like that. They should make a movie of the books just to have that scene in it.
I know it was, and the, you know, the complexity of thought, the duality happening in your mind, which is to say, first of all, there's the idea of life and death. I mean, I've ridden horses, but it's a strange horse, a brilliantly trained horse, and yet you're traveling over ground that you do not know, and you're just suddenly, without anticipation or preparation, you're running. I mean, running, and that's already you're thinking about, you know, that horse stepping in a gopher hole and catapulting you into the next state and breaking your neck. And there's that. So you start there. At the same time, there's this sort of mano a mano element of not allowing yourself to show that terror because you're, you know, a man of the West and you want to make this Western. And I don't believe it was done as a test. I do not think so. I think it's his natural ebullience, but nonetheless, that's part of it, you know. And then there's this thing that's happening, which is you're meeting this person for the first time and you're trying to take their measure and you're casting because you're not going to get them to read. And how do you make those decisions? And how do you know what it's like to work with someone like that? And that's happening at the same time. So all of these things are happening at that moment as you're going, you know, in across the Western Plains.
I mean, it's such a big decision for you because on one side you're thinking, right, if I get Tom Cruise, I'll get a budget, which is X and all the rest of it. But if I get Tom Cruise and he's not right for the movie, he's the Annette Bening in 30-something, then it doesn't matter how big my budget is. It doesn't matter all that stuff.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, and by the way, think of Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt in The Interview with a Vampire when neither of them are right. and it just is an even bigger disaster. I mean, these things do happen. You know, it's like casting by celebrity. And that's, by the way, that I talk about that in the book, but it's interesting that when I wanted to cast Ken Watanabe, they thought that Hiro Sanada should be the daimyo of the samurai at that moment. And he wasn't what we'd written. He's magnificent. As, by the way, if you've seen the Shogun that they're doing now, this in the series, you may have your thoughts pro or con for it, but undeniable is the magnificence of his performance. So he was great, but was not that gilded celebrity that by which Japan had often chosen their stars in their movies. And there was all sorts of pushback about doing that because he wasn't at that level. So, you know, it works in both ways.
It's such a wonderful film in terms of marrying, you know, being a Western Eastern, you know, marrying those two you know, two concepts together, and a real one of the things that you talk about when you're talking about the making of that film as well, and it sort of comes up a couple of times with Legends of the Fall. You're saying, yeah, of course, nowadays we would do this with CGI, or nowadays this you wouldn't, you know. And you know, going back to Lawrence of Arabia, I think you credit as well with a certain sort of giving a visual vocabulary for that kind of epic. Although I think it's really interesting that you talk about it's a treatment of time rather than the number of people that makes an epic. You know, I think that's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that, you know, that the fact that these kinds of films on these this kind of scale wouldn't be made just because of the technological solutions that might rule out some of the solutions that you had at the time.
You know, I don't know if it's that necessarily, because I think you're seeing now the adaptation of technological solutions to, you know, certain conventional storytelling. In other words, the scale of sets and the scale of real time, real scale, they've gotten better at adapting set extensions and sense of place. And even action, you know, in the beginning, because they could do it, they did it. In other words, why have 1,000 orcs when you can have 10 million orcs? You know, if you can make the camera go through a keyhole and around and up and down, well, let's do that. But that seems to have settled down in certain ways. But what I think the problem is the obligation on studios to become profit centers in a very different way than they ever were, because they're trying to fulfill the mandates of multinational corporations that give them profit and loss goals that if they don't meet them, that affects the stock price. And I think they're then obliged to do things that they think will be appealing to the general public and to the greatest number of people in the shortest number of weeks. And that means IP and comic books and child, you know, more blanc mange, a thinner soup, you know, that means it's going to be an entertainment, and that's what we're going to sell, because the adults are hard to get in the theater, and they're picky and they're demanding. And we've in fact spent a lot of time now not training a younger audience to look to watch aspirationally. You know, there's a time in the book when I mention all the films that I saw when I was 13 or 12 or 14. Those were grown-up movies. They weren't making them for me. I was looking up to them. And I think that's also been a legacy now over time that is different.
There was a recent article in, I think it was Harper's Bazaar yesterday, about Hollywood. And it was essentially saying that because of the private equity investment in Hollywood, it used this comparison that they were stripping the houses of copper. They were just taking everything out of the studios, and it was wasn't it just wasn't a sustainable financial model for a creative industry, paying writers, squeezing writers too much, you know, all the whole enchilada.
And yes, and they're not investing in R&D in the same way that they did with a number of scripts that they're having been writing, and more writers given work and doing things, you know, that they are given the time to do and the ambition to do. It's a lot about ambition. I mean, you know, if you set the bar low and you hit it, well, there you are, you know, but if you aspire in some way and you don't necessarily hit it, but you come close, you're already creating something that is an inspiration to other filmmakers, to audiences, to, you know, but you are held to a higher standard by critics. Critics are notoriously, I think, ungenerous toward the ambitious film that fails. I find them curiously a kind of, what's that phrase? A nostalgie de la boue. They are conspicuously eager to be slumming and to show their slumming creds, that they too can like, you know, a crummy action film.
Absolutely. The idea that I don't want to be a snob. So yes, Fast and Furious is wonderful, But the latest Martin Scorsese is so disappointing because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't achieve blah, blah, blah. And well, at least it's trying to achieve blah, blah, blah. At least it's trying to get there.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
I mean, on that, no, I do feel sort of sparks of optimism, little ironic glimmers of light, as W.H. Auden might say, of, you know, Oppenheimer.
I know, but I, by the way, this is to take nothing away from Oppenheimer, but that's a man who has earned such currency and such, you know, he has gained a perch, and he's chosen to spend that currency on something like that, and it worked. But I, you know, I will just say that having been a member of the Motion Picture Academy for a very long time, that when they expanded the list of those movies that could be nominated for Best Picture to 10, I could not find five this year that I thought were worthy of that title. And it did not used to be that way.
Yeah, yeah. It's sometimes difficult to get a top 10, and you find yourself. I mean, I'm lucky because I get to go to festivals and I get to see films from all over the world, and they make up 50%, 70% of, you know.
You bet.
I mean, I look at, there was a film out recently called The Teacher's Lounge, which came out of Germany.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Unbelievable, you know, and it's just like, why don't we have a film about teachers, you know?
Exactly.
Listen, Ed, you've been absolutely brilliant talking to me, and very generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on Writers on Film.
Oh, you're very welcome. I was going to ask you one thing. Have you looked at what Steve Zaillian has been doing with Ridley?
Yes, Italy, right? I am. Yeah, and I love Patricia Highsmith. I've seen the first three episodes, I think.
Well, I mean, first of all, Bob Elswit's work and Steve's work is so controlled and rigorous in a way that I've never seen on television to this moment. I think it's a real step up, but also has been in Italy, the fetishizing of Italy for international audiences. I thought you would appreciate, since you are there and you're amidst the reality of it and you're seeing that 1960s vision of it. I thought that would be amusing.
We've got White Lotus. I was in Taormina to cover the film festival last June. And one of the bars, just to go and have a drink, because it's in the White Lotus season 2, you have to book to have a drink there. I don't want to stay in a room. I don't want to, but you have to phone up and say, I want to come and have a cocktail or a beer or something. And
Well, listen, it's very nice talking to you, and this kind of conversation is really fun for me. So thank you.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more. Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.